This episode is sponsored by Canaccord Genuity Wealth Management, experienced wealth managers who go above and beyond to guide and support you. CanDo is more than just an attitude. It's navigating today for a brighter tomorrow. Visit candowealth.com.
Hello and welcome to Women Balls, where I, Katie Balls, speak to today's trailblazers. My guest today grew up in Essex to quite the political family. Three of her grandparents were in the House of Lords. Her career in Westminster began in the 1970s, and in 2005 she co-founded Women to Win with the future Prime Minister Theresa May, aimed at encouraging more women to get into politics and stand as Conservative candidates. The results today are clear to see. She was made a life peer in 2011 for services to charity and politics. My guest today is Anne Jenkin. Anne, thank you very much for joining me today for the podcast.
Pleasure.
We tend to start at the beginning when it comes to whether you would say your childhood was a happy one.
I would. It was a traditional sort of 1950s, 60s childhood. Big garden, lots of running around outside, biking, swimming in lakes, holidays by the sea in Wales, and spending a lot of time with family and friends who had ponies, that sort of thing. Old-fashioned.
And I mentioned in the introduction that you come from a very political family. So I think three of your grandparents in the House of Lords, I believe two of them also in the Commons. How did that manifest itself growing up? Were you very aware of their roles from an early age?
I was aware that they were sort of important people, if you like. Both my mother's parents were MPs. My grandmother was the 33rd ever woman MP. And her father, as a Liberal MP, introduced the first women's suffrage bill in 1907. In fact, I sometimes think those fantasy dinner parties would be quite interesting. I knew, obviously, my grandparents well, but my great-grandparents, because at the same time as he, Willoughby Dickinson, was doing that suffrage stuff, my other one was winning the first Nobel Prize for Physics, which I'm afraid I've not inherited a single drop of. But so my grandmother was very much an important part of my life growing up. We spent a lot of time with her. She retired from the House of Commons in 1959, was a very, very early peer in 1962, I think. And we, whenever my parents were abroad, we'd go and stay with my grandparents. So I knew very much she was an important part of my life.
So no pressure, really, growing up in your family.
Well, it didn't feel like that, actually. And subsequently, people like you will say, oh, well, obviously that's why you got involved with women in politics. But I do genuinely feel it was a coincidence. But I like to hope she's looking down and approvingly at what I have achieved for them, yes.
And therefore, obviously, you talk about growing up in the 50s. Did it feel as though you kind of grew up in quite a feminist household in terms of your family?
No, I don't think so. My father was born in 1910 and was quite traditional. And in fact, I think if I'd been in a feminist household, I'd have been more encouraged to go to university, for example. My mother was a wonderful, warm, welcoming matriarch, but particularly because my father died actually quite young. So she was on her own for a long time. But she was very, very, yeah, she would encourage us to have lots of people to stay and have fun and do lots of old-fashioned sort of things.
And you mentioned you didn't go to university, but in terms of school, were you particularly academic? Were you naughty? You showed me a look there. I feel that means that you were not naughty.
I was not naughty. I found a diary a few years ago that it was exactly Bridget Jones. It was like, you know, 9 stone 7, must start a diet. But we didn't have any opportunity. I was at Sherburn School for Girls in Dorset, and which was thankfully a bit more ambitious for the girls than many boarding schools of my date. But we didn't mix with any boys. Of course, like every teenager, we were kind of, our hormones were surging and we were boy mad, but never had the chance to meet any. So I think school was just something to be got through. I certainly remember shivering on the lacrosse field and the food being absolutely disgusting. But there wasn't any choice for us. We just had to get through it, come out the other side and be sort of grown up.
And then did you have then aspirations in terms of what you wanted to be when you were no longer at school and you were older?
Not at all. I mean, I've been extremely lucky that the opportunities have come my way, but I never planned anything. You know, lots of girls do today, ambitious girls and obviously ambitious men have always done it, but, you know, you plot your path. And that's never been the case for me. I mean, I've had opportunities and I've been extremely lucky the way that it's all panned out.
Now, as you said, you did not go to university. Is it fair to say you still had plenty of friends here at university?
Yes,
very much so. Some at Oxford and so forth.
Yes, very much so. I mean, we were definitely, weekends would be spent racing off to Oxford or Cambridge or wherever it might be and having fun.
Because there's always a story involving you and Richard Curtis.
Yes.
I groan, but we'll get on to more serious points soon.
It's a slight exaggeration, let's put it that way. But I did know him. I do know him from time to time. I see him even now. But it is certainly true that he, well, I was going to say went through a stage, but I think he still does. Every time he writes anything, he writes a character called Bernard, which was, let's call it inspired by my former husband. And so I think taking the piss out of that and politics and so on. But it was his idea of a private joke,
and,
I think.
And eventually I get a bit too successful, I suppose, to have a private joke at some point.
Well, I think I got a feeling he did something at Christmas that still included a Bernard or a Bernard, but it's well known. It's now, I think it's probably a kind of Trivial Pursuit question, but anyway, it's been quite amusing.
Brilliant. And I suppose when we're talking about your career after, you're going to all these different universities, you have a social set that's very much a university.
Yeah.
In terms of your next steps and what you plan to do you get quite involved in the Conservative Party around this point? Or
no, it was luck, really, or perhaps not luck. I mean, most of my
we'll go with luck.
jobs, you call it a career, Katie. That's a modern word for me. I call it a job. But
very
well,
grand.
Because the first job happened to be in what was then called Central Office. Well, we didn't actually have PAs in those days. I was secretary to a bit of an old battle axe. And then that kind of developed because then I went to work in the House of Commons. Every now and again, I made a dash for freedom and the elastic has snapped me back. And I've ended up by really spending most of my adult life in the political world. But that's got advantages because, well, I mean, obviously now I'm in a very privileged position and a legislator too, but it was never part of a plan. But it did mean that I knew everybody. Because I spent so many years in the Commons as what subsequently became a PA, though, interestingly, when I started, we were all women there because we had to do the typing and the, you know, constituency work. Actually, interestingly, I worked for three MPs and I was their only member of staff. Well, now today it is significantly different, let's call it that. But there were almost no men working there. And today there are very, very few women working there. There was a sort of great, we call it the dragon area, but down in the basement, there were loads of middle-aged women. They felt old to me, bashing away at their typewriters, organising their members of parliament. So there's been a big change in the sort of people who work there now, because they're all now, as far as I can see, young men.
And I think actually you might have the, I'm going to go with honour,
yeah,
of being the most cited Women on this podcast who's yet to be on the podcast. In the sense, every time we have a Tory MP on, they often say, you get to the point where you say, oh, so why did you decide to be an MP? And about whether it's the first answer, the one immediately after, the name Anne Jenkin comes up, and then Women to Win. Obviously, you co-founder of Theresa May. What eventually, you know, was there something early on and then eventually you got to the point of thinking, actually, I want to do something about the diversity of candidates?
I stood for Parliament myself in 1987.
In Glasgow.
Yeah. I mean, that was partly because Bernard was fighting another Glasgow seat and I thought I might as well go and spend some time with him. And they honestly couldn't find people to stand in those seats. And it was an experience. But I mean, I personally hated the hostility of it, even then, that people would, sort of spit at you, yeah, in the street.
Because I'm not sure Glasgow would be the most welcoming place.
Well, he was fighting
a Glasgow seat.
Well, I'll tell you, there is an advantage in fighting a seat that everybody knows is hostile. If you were fighting, I don't know, Heywood under Middleton or something or other, people might not be aware that it was a hostile place. So it was that. But it did clarify for me that I didn't want to go on with it. Then, Bernard was elected, we had small children, and I did what I could on the sidelines, really. And I think what happened was in, let me get the date right, 2005, before the election, there were two women who were deselected. And it was something to do with them wearing a skirt that was too short or not short enough. I don't remember, but it was not, it was absurd. And I knew it was sort of men that were members of the Rotary Club and played golf together that were doing it. And I poked about a bit. I made some comment to the press then. Then I was asked to write an article for the Sunday Times, I think, about how to level the playing field for women to get selected. I hadn't thought about it very much until then. And then I did Woman's Hour just after the election, where we were still stuck at 9%. And I usually spin that round to say, so 91% men. you know, everybody had bought into it. They all wanted it to happen, but nobody did anything. And I remember sitting in the green room waiting to go and see Jenny Murray, and there was a comedian in there. And some researcher came in and she said to this woman coming after me, "Oh, you're on after a piece about women in the Conservative Party, so that won't take long." And they sniggered. And I was so ashamed. And I went in and I told this story live on air with Jenny Murray. And then I thought, well, OK, I've got to stop looking over my shoulder for somebody else to do something. And I looked in the mirror and I thought, OK, I've got to do it. And I had a conversation. I remember it was 7-7, you know, some date. So it was the date of the London bombings. And Teresa and I and a lot of other senior people were at a breakfast event. And we said, we've got to do something. And what is that something going to be? And we had lots of meetings over the summer and over the autumn. And we launched in November 21. And we thought, we didn't know what we were then, actually, but we thought we were a sort of ginger group there to rattle the cage and shout at the party. But David Cameron was then elected leader about 2 weeks later. And his first speech said, "I want my party to better represent the country I'm seeking to lead." And so in a way, we then had a bit of a green light and off we went. And in that period from 2005, we've inched our way slowly from, I think it was 17 women MPs to 46 to 60 something and now to 80 something. But basically it's gone from that 9% up to 25%. Based, you know, on merit with no positive action of any kind. But let's just remind ourselves that, I mean, it's still 75% men, it's still 25% women. It's not good enough, but there are reasons which need to be addressed to make that better.
And on that, we look at the current candidate selection at the moment. And there was an interesting FT piece, which I know you quoted in, but also Chewing the Figures, which is, I think, of the candidates selected so far for the next election, about 70% are male. So technically, that's what, a tiny bit better than the current makeup, but I mean, it doesn't feel like that.
So, Katie, it's broadly always 30%. So 30% come forward, 30% get onto the candidates list, which is in itself a very rigorous process, and 30% get selected. So, I mean, if we actually got to 30% elected, I, for one, would be extremely pleased. But that's why it is a slow process. I mean, the point I made to Lucy in the article was that we have two problems. One is that women are not applying for seats, and I can't entirely blame them for that. Partly that's because they know that there are a lot of retirement seats coming up, so they're waiting for those, as I imagine.
Some men are waiting too.
Yes, I was going to, I'm sure lots of people are waiting. But the point I made, you know, you have to apply. And by the way, we got a woman selected in Bishop Auckland at the weekend because she had applied. And then the other factor, which has always been the case, but it's much worse, where associations are picking local. And that is a problem for us because many of our women are professionally based in London, will go anywhere, but they are not going to be based in wherever it is that they're selecting. Where we have a local woman, they are selecting them, but that's not always the case. Our more high-flying professional women are based in London and waiting to go wherever it is that will select them, but they're not always going to be local.
And as you said, the rise of local candidates is a trend that we've seen the past couple of elections. What do you think is encouraging local, or making it so local associations are more likely to go for what they know?
Well, I think it's partly they're nervous about losing and they think that a local will be better known and that might be, you know, might help. But they've always got a, you know, our Bob or whoever it might be. And I'm sure that our Bob is busy, you know, lobbying behind the scenes to ensure that the competition is not there. I think that a lot of them are no longer looking for, you know, potential cabinet ministers. I don't know if you remember, but William Hague did an article not long ago in The Times saying safe seats have a responsibility to pick future cabinet ministers. And he said we did that in Richmond when he left and they picked Rishi, who was obviously, you know, not local, far from it. And I think we, as the party at the centre, needs to make that point more vociferously to constituencies when they're selecting.
And I suppose if the numbers stay as they are, do you think, you know, some will argue, well, what about all women shortlists? Do you think that there is a lack of progress, or it looks as though the party's going back as something that should ever be considered, or not really?
Well, what I've always said and what I will continue to say is if we go backwards, all options should be on the table. But there is no sign of that at the moment. And we, you know, significantly bumped up last time. okay, obviously we won a lot of seats we weren't necessarily expecting to, but I don't think we can see that till afterwards. But I do think, I mean, you were kind enough to say that every woman's, you know, you might have interviewed a lot of women who said that I encourage them. And it is true that I've been at it for so long now, I can kind of smell a successful candidate. Or I can smell, you know, I've got a feel for who will be what it takes.
What sense are you trying to pick up?
Well, I can't
put it that way.
I can't quite explain it to you. It's character in the end. Yeah. It's not your CV, really. Are you resilient? Do you have views? You know, what kind of country do you want to live in, and can you articulate that? It's not going with the crowd. And by the way, the women are very often driven by causes. So they may have had cancer, got a disabled child, got an autistic sibling. Men just know they're going to be great. And so those women need to be looked for. And it's not really my job to do so, though. I mean, I keep an eye open for them all the time. But the party should have... So they're mostly campaigners. And they should have an outreach programme, which, you know, they do from time to time, but it's never consistent and never sustained. Quite often people will say, oh, will you have a word with so-and-so? I think she's got what it takes. And, you know, a cup of coffee usually tells me. But then they have to go through the process. And, of course, not everybody who applies to get onto the candidates list gets through the first time round. But partly what we do at Women to Win is turn them from professional people, whatever they might be, into more of a political person. I mean, we've got an excellent woman who's just been selected for Henley. I remember seeing her for the first time about, I don't know, 8 years ago. And I could tell that with a bit of experience, she would have what it took. But it has taken her those 8 years really to understand the party and politics. And she's been a county councillor. I think she may also be a district councillor. But it's a journey. If you go straight in, it's a different world. You know that. So we're there to help them navigate the maze to get to where they want to get to. You can't usually do it straight away. And it takes time to understand it. And you've got to do kind of apprenticeship, really.
And so for listeners who are not so well-versed in what Women to Win does, effectively it is giving the women who have the potential the tools to know how to navigate the Tory party, a local constituency, the things you need to do, what it might be like, and then also how to stand up in front of the room and say, you know, I had an old colleague who used to call it fig jam, which is F, I'm good.
Yes, so we work closely with the Conservative Women's Organisation, but they mostly do sort of courses and things at an earlier stage for councillors and so on. Whereas we usually work with women who've already passed their parliamentary assessment centre, which means that they are officially on the candidates list. And I would say that I think our control system is better than the other political parties, because I think the other political parties, you can still just get a tap on the shoulder. And for us, it is quite a rigorous procedure to get through and get on the candidates list. But we've done quite a lot of weekends away in a youth hostel, where we would do a whole weekend of mock selections for sure, but other useful sessions, how to fill in your CV so that you can get, you know, so that they're likely to want to interview you and so on. So yes, every Monday evening we do mock selections, what we call Speaker's Corner. So somebody will come and give us their speech. We'll do Q&A practice. We give feedback. They'll come back in a few weeks' time. And we have other volunteers who will hear that speech until they're absolutely word perfect. But it is about, you see, if you're coming from a professional background, you're used to presenting to your shareholders or your board and not to, you know, your old Auntie Betty or people who have not had so much experience with interviewing. And so it's about kind of, in a way, deprofessionalizing you, you know, letting you be yourself, because people want to see who are you, why are you there, and why should they pick you? And that's really what we try to do with them.
Now, I want to talk about some of the other issues we've spoken on, but just before we do, as a member of the House of Lords, we've spoken a bit about candidate selection. We've had a bit of a rise in terms of younger peers entering the House of Lords recently, partly through resignation honours lists. I think Boris Johnson brought two quite young figures in, one being a woman who I think is now the youngest peer. And then I think with the latest list, do you welcome youth to the House of Lords?
Well, what I am disappointed by is that since David Cameron started appointing people, I was a very early one of those and very lucky to be a beneficiary of it, we've actually gone from 26% of the Conservative Party in the Lords being women down to 25%. And the reason I'm disappointed about that is because it's the one place where you can, you know, the prime minister of the day can make the difference. Now, I know in part that's because women don't perhaps promote themselves as enthusiastically as perhaps some of the men do. But it's a shame because our front bench, for example, is disproportionately women. And I see them, they work hard, they do a fantastically good job. And by the way, you talked about young women. Jojo Penn, who is on our, been a minister now for quite a long time, Theresa May's former deputy chief of staff, has absolutely stepped up. She's actually about to go on maternity leave for the second time. And she is a highly capable and competent and well-respected minister. The problem is about coming in young is that you probably can't afford to live on the allowances. We don't get a salary. And that means that you mostly have to do other jobs as well, which means that you cannot be a full-time peer, which is fine because, you know, it's not designed to be a full-time job. But that is an issue for the younger ones. And frankly, it would be better to choose more people in the like recently retired age group who can give, you know, more time to it, full time to it. So we'll see whether they step up and whether, you know, they're prepared to get actively involved. I mean, we welcome anybody who's actually active.
And then looking at other issues,
yeah,
I think one of the areas where you've made headlines in the past, not that we should judge every issue by column inches.
Please don't.
But I mean, you spoke in the past a lot about, you know, LGBT equality, but you've also described yourself as gender critical. And I wondered, you know, speaking to some on the Labour side with gender critical views, considering it's another place your name comes up as someone who works with these groups to kind of organise, and how have you found that experience?
Yes, I think, I mean, I'm a big supporter of LGBT and same-sex attraction. And I did support, which I think is what you're alluding to, I very much supported same-sex marriage. But there is a difference between LGBT and T. There is a difference between same-sex attraction and an ideology or how you identify yourself to be. And I think that those two issues have become very conflated in recent years, and people march about shouting no LGBT without the T. I don't really understand why that's the case. So, yes, I am concerned about women's sex-based rights, and I'm concerned that they are being rolled back in some cases. I'm concerned that women's single-sex spaces can be under threat. And I very much work on holding the line on that. I'm also concerned about safeguarding children because there is a push for particularly girls. There is a 5,000% increase in the number of girls presenting with gender distress. And the statistics show that a large number of them are either same-sex attracted, so they're lesbians, and there's quite a lot of what they call internalised homophobia from them. I mean, we had a meeting quite recently with Keira Bell, who you will remember had a significant case about being against the Tavistock. She would forever, because of the testosterone she's taken, has stubble, hairy chest, no breasts, deep voice. And I'm just anxious that we don't allow too many children to go down that route without thinking very carefully about the longer term consequences of it. So yes, I have got more interested in those issues. I'm very worried about sport for girls, prisons and so on. So I am interested and I am involved in it.
And I wondered on that, because I think it's fair to say you've worked for some Labour MPs as well, Tory MPs, when it comes to, you know, actually going cross-party with some of these issues which affect others. Do you think our current two male leaders in Rishi Sunak and Keir Starmer, I say the two main parties, are attuned to the delicacy of these issues?
No, I think you say delicacy. Nobody is suggesting that we shouldn't be anything other than respectful of those who have gender issues or I like to identify themselves as another gender. But you have to be careful of the impact of that on other people. So we work cross-party and we work with lots of other external groups, and I have the greatest respect for them for the work that they've done as well.
And just a final question on that. I just wondered if you had any thoughts when Rishi Sunak was criticised quite recently in the Commons chamber for ultimately saying Keir Starmer didn't know where a woman was, when the parents of Brianna Gay, the murdered trans school child, were in the gallery.
Well, first of all, I don't believe they were in the gallery, actually.
Right.
I think that was something
I think has been disputed.
Yes, okay, maybe. Yeah. But I don't suppose he knew that was the case. I mean, he was trying to make the point, which I think was well understood, that Keir Starmer had changed his mind on quite a number of issues. And he Keir Starmer used to say, yes, a woman can have a penis, and now he's sort of moved. So I think that was the point which most people understood, that the Prime Minister was just making that point. But I think there was a lot of sort of confected rage around it. And out in the country, I shouldn't think anybody took any notice or understood what the hell it was all about.
Talking about anxiety in younger women, one of the big debates at the moment involves smartphones and social media. And I think there's some talk of a potential ban on social media, though obviously there's a big question about how practically you would do that. Also a ban on smartphones, almost like overlap to a degree. And again, how you get most parents to go along with that. But that's something you're quite passionate about.
I suppose, I mean, I consider myself to be extremely lucky that I was brought up in a world before actually even the internet. And indeed that my children were too, because I see the pressures now, but not up close as a parent, which I see and hear it from other people. I think that people are increasingly aware that a lot of the mental health issues, the anxiety, the sadness, does appear to be driven by what's going on their phones. And there is more understanding now, more articles. There was something in the Saturday Times. They asked kids how much time they spent on the phone. Well, if it really is 7-8 hours a day, how can they possibly be either interacting with friends? How can they be learning anything? How can they be learning in schools? How can they pass exams? So I think there is a better understanding, and I'm only, on the fringes of it, but that something needs to be done. I think parents would be extremely glad if something was done. And it's interesting that if you look at focus groups of young people themselves, they said, I would love for it not to exist. TikTok in particular seems to be an issue there. I mean, I got particularly concerned when we were debating the online safety bill about the access to pornography and what that was doing to children and what it does to your brain when you see it too young. And I think that part of the anxiety about sex and gender is that girls see, extreme hardcore porn. It's not like my generation had the top shelf magazines. It's really violent stuff. And I think they see it and they think, if that's what it's like to be a woman, I want to opt out of being a woman. And there's more evidence to show that's the case. So there's a growing movement of people concerned and anxious about it. And I'm very happy to support and encourage and help people with that campaign.
Now, just a few final questions for me. One was, when I was doing research for this podcast, I discovered that you are rather thrifty.
Yeah.
I found an old article where it said that you stash Aldi coffee in a Fortnum & Mason tin and use laddered tights to make your own marmalade. And also, when it comes to clothes, I didn't think you buy clothes new.
No.
Can you give us some tips?
That's a very old article, but it's still true. Actually, funnily enough, when the marmalade point, which I do make my own, very good, though I say so myself, great tip is to use about half the sugar that any recipe tells you to. But somebody gave me then a jelly bag and I'm like, no, that's not the point. So to get away from the tights point. I am frugal and I absolutely hate food waste. I think I must have been a war baby in another lifetime. So yes, I made a vow about 12 years ago to never buy anything new for the rest of my life. Now that isn't difficult. I mean, that doesn't mean to say I never buy anything. I buy it either on eBay or at a charity shop. And we've had some very good swishing parties, including in the House of Lords, actually, which is where you swap clothes. And so it's refreshed when you when you start wearing some other old baroness's dress. It's a different thing. Yeah, I loathe fast fashion. It makes me very anxious about what we're doing environmentally. Kids who buy one T-shirt and throw it away. I mean, the sort of thing I can't bear is when at Glastonbury, they all leave their tents behind. I mean, what is that about? And food, by the way, just to drop in, I'm also anxious about food and the implication of that. And we've just managed to get a select committee on ultra-processed foods, which we've just started work on because we're basically now young people are eating. I mean, obesity has been a big theme, but young people are now eating 80% of their diet is based on ultra-processed foods, which is basically an industrially processed edible substance, but not really food. So, I mean, that's another passion. But yeah, frugality.
So what's an average meal in your house?
It's usually soup, usually be leftovers. Don't forget, I'm on my own, Katie, so I don't have very much of that. But I will batch cook for sure. I'm very keen on dal. I like lentil based. I don't eat meat for environmental and I don't like the taste anyway. So yeah, most things would be what's nowadays called plant-based, but I used to call vegetables.
Yeah, you don't need the fashionable phrase.
Yes. And by the way, I mean, I'm lucky enough to have a vegetable garden that we, in my commune, we all share. And I'll do apple puree and freeze it for the winter and like a squirrel.
Now, you were a friend of Margaret Thatcher's. And I wonder, just for our listeners, we often talk about Thatcher also on this podcast, but it's very much Thatcher the politician. What was the more personal side of her like?
Well, I wasn't a friend of hers when she was in power, because I would never have dared. Would have been far too intimidating. So I only really got to know her when she retired from public life, really, and was more frail. She used to have a saying, if she came to dinner or whatever, she used to say, "I couldn't have done it on my own. Everyone in this room played their part," which was a rather wonderful way of making everybody feel included, even though that wasn't necessarily the case. I mean, I think she was a wonderful inspiration to, I mean, when you stop to consider how she achieved, what she achieved, where she came from, and how difficult the journey was then compared to how it is today, and that it really, she was absolutely phenomenal. But incidentally, we had a young black girl come and talk to us in the Lords recently. She'd been given a project to do on leadership, and everybody else in the school chose South American dictators or whatever. And she chose Mrs. Thatcher and was completely ostracised by the whole school as a result. And I do think, I mean, I was pretty horrified to hear that, really, that they, it wasn't to do with, you know, what Mrs. Thatcher had said, done, or anything else. It was about leadership, which, for God's sake, I mean, you know, she really had in spades. And I do think that we've kind of, it's time for a bit more rehabilitation, I think, of her. There's just a feeling that she was evil. And she was, of course, the most extraordinary woman who completely transformed this country. And I was very privileged to be, you know, to have known her towards the end of her life.
Now, the final question on this podcast is one we ask everyone, which is the worst advice you've been given. I'm sure you've been given some bad advice.
Well, I've racked my brains about this, Katie. And I mean, as someone who has struggled with imposter syndrome and, you know, don't like going outside my comfort zone very much, I've mostly had to give myself firm advice to step up and do things myself. And in fact, I asked my sister, and she said, "I think you should say there are only two kinds of fools, those who give advice and those who take it," because I honestly couldn't think of any really bad advice. You know, you have to kind of make your own luck and seize your own opportunities. And I know that's easy for me to say because I've had so many. And obviously, I'm being asked to give advice quite often. But I think that I really couldn't think of anything bad. I've made my own bad decisions, of course, but not, I can't blame anybody else for that.
Yeah, you have to take responsibility for those ones. And thank you, Anne, for joining today.
Pleasure.